The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Are you interested in the cutting edge of investing? That means frontier and emerging markets. And would you like to get started? Or perhaps you are already investing but still have questions. Welcome to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. On today's program, we'll take a look at news, trends, and background information that you should know to become an informed investor in new and emerging opportunities. Now, here is your host, Gavin Graham.
Hello, I'm Gavin Graham, and here we are with our weekly look at emerging and frontier markets. I'm here on Voice America every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Eastern, 6 a.m. Pacific, and 2 p.m. in the UK. Each week, I talk to Wall Street veterans, fund managers, analysts, and journalists on the ground in these markets. We sift through the opportunities that they offer and suggest what works right now and what we believe will work in the future. I spent most of my professional life analyzing investments and hiring fund managers to handle large amounts of investors' money. I figure I can spot the difference between promising investments and those which are perhaps a little less promising. My guests and I provide you with the information you need in order to clear up the confusion surrounding emerging market investments and where you should be looking at today. And I'm very pleased to be starting today with Richard Guler in New York. His career parallels the development of the emerging markets themselves. Then I'll go on to Baku, Azerbaijan, to talk to Silk Invest Wazim Khan. During earlier editions, we've looked at several former Soviet bloc countries, which are moving with greater or lesser speed down the road to market economy status. Today, we'll be looking at Azerbaijan with Wazim, and his portfolio responsibilities at Silk Invest also include Pakistan. We'll be talking about that country. From there, I'll go back to Medellin, Colombia, for a look at Colombian equities with Rupert Stebbings of Valores Bancolombia, and then I'll close off today's edition with our African correspondent, Samuel Okoja, and his report on the African activities of some of the global telecom companies that you may have in your global funds. The professional career of my first guest today, as I mentioned, parallels the development of our interest generally in the developed world in emerging and frontier markets. Richard Guler was a senior portfolio manager at Battery March Financial Management from 1984 to 90, and he established several emerging market funds for institutional investors, one of them focusing exclusively on Brazil, another one on Brazil, Mexico, Chile, Argentina, and Venezuela. From there, he went on to be chief investment officer at Baybanks Investment Management and a consultant with companies such as Fidelity Investment. He's now president of Argyle Investment Consulting and Argyle Trading Systems. I have him on the line here from New York. Welcome to the program, Rich.
Thank you very much, Gavin. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Thank you, because I think it's fair to say, without wanting to date you too much, that you've probably seen the entire history of emerging and frontier markets as investable opportunities for developed market investors. In the 1980s, probably most investment professionals had little interest. I certainly don't recall a great deal when I started looking at these markets back at the late 80s. What led you and Battery March to start these funds?
Well, Dean LeBaron was a wonderful mentor and visionary as the head of Battery March and really the sole owner. He was always interested in exploring new opportunities, and he understood in a way that even to this day, not as many of his peers do, that being early in a new opportunity greatly reduces the risk that you're taking. Discomfort correlates with the potential for very high returns. But given that that was his bias, he also was a great believer that the best way to deliver the Battery March message as a contrarian value institutional manager was to have all of us make speeches and go out and make mistakes and recover from them as quickly as we could. I seem to specialize in that. So I volunteered in the way that you're not supposed to in the U.S. military for anything that was new and interesting. Dean was invited to speak before the global stock market heads in, I think it was either Rio or Sao Paulo in Brazil in 1988. And you never knew what Dean would do. He would deliver a 40-minute speech from a single 3x5 card. So you can imagine the way his mind might work in a circumstance. He basically got before these folks and he said, look, we are on the edge of being able to trade from Switzerland in every market in the world via satellite and via data links. The money has there is no bias by individual currency anymore. All those problems will be worked out. And I think that there are tremendous opportunities based on any economy that wants to grow and attract capital. Well, this is kind of what a lot of the South American heads of the of their markets wanted to hear. And whoever was the host that day strategically placed Dean at a table afterward at a dinner next to a fellow named David Gill, who recently wrote a book on frontier investing. I'm not quite sure what the title is. I should know because he sent me a copy, which I'm very grateful for. David was the head of the International Finance Corporation of the World Bank. And I don't have any you know, released, blacked out memos from the IFC or the World Bank as to what their goal in life was. But my take was that if socialism and disruptive political and economic systems were going to be moving toward markets that the United States cared about, rather than have a military intervention, they would have a financial intervention. So the World Bank would raise money via bond issues and then find ways to selectively encourage local capital markets to be open rather than closed. And
that seems to work pretty well.
And I think the conversation went something like David Gill to Dean, well, if I gave you $20 million, could you raise some more money? Dean never backed off of something like that. And he said, well, of course, how much do you want me to raise? Rather than, well, I don't know. I have to go check with my partners.
Yep.
David said, okay, we'll get back to me. Dean came back, pulled us all into a room, and he said, I've just called all of our institutional clients, and I said that we have the opportunity to do a Brazil fund to start off. Would they come up with $80 million? Because the IFC would come up with $20 million. And it's GM, AT&T, et cetera, said, absolutely. In fact, I think some of them were upset that they got capped out at $100 million. It all evolved from that circumstance. And within 6 months, I was on the ground on a trip to Latin America to go get the data. And I realized we were one of the dirty secrets of Battery March. If Dean is listening, forgive me, Dean, for revealing it. But in the process of creating $200 million plus Latin American funds, we never visited a single company. It was done entirely off of data that we were good data people. We could we could smell clean data versus not so clean data.
That is a movie that didn't make mistakes
along the way. But we were very good at this, and we took that very seriously as fiduciaries. And so all of a sudden, a trip to Mexico and Venezuela produced one batch of data. We had Mexican data from. Was being provided back then, I think, by the old Capital International before Morgan Stanley took them over. But I'm not 100% sure about that in my recollection.
I think it was 1989 anyway. But yes. you had the data and you were able to make the investment decisions on the basis of that.
Yeah, and the first question that came up in the Brazil Fund was, because Dean was very practical. We sat in a room having established a relationship with Banco Bozzano Simonsen in Rio. And they were going to provide us with company data, and we thought we'd get it like on 20 companies, and this was a fax and package in the mail world. There was no email yet to move things around. In comes a package that was bigger than we thought. And so I sit down with the head of data assembly that we had several people on the staff that were very good at this. fellow named Jerry Chisholm and Don O'Hara were my chief cohorts here. And lo and behold, there was at least 10 years of data on about 225 Brazilian companies. And some of them were pretty small. And he said, and we sort of raised our eyebrows and said, you know, does anybody really know whether the companies exist? And we made a few phone calls and spot checked it. And sure enough, they all existed. Banco was in the Siemens and was a very honorable partner. But Dean looked at me and he said, well, if inflation has run at extremely high levels in this market, you know, our valuation models are very good at doing both relative and absolute. Absolute would have been an early battery mart strategy to buy both Braniff and Chrysler. And, of course, Braniff mm-hmm. went bankrupt and Chrysler went from 4 to 30. And in these strategies, client embarrassment can be a factor, but returns are usually pretty good if you buy a basket and equal weight it, which was our tendency. And so Dean said, what do you do in high inflation? And I said, well, let's assume that everybody survives. And everybody has to, I said, I don't want to use the word in a pejorative sense, cheats the same way in a high inflation mm-hmm. environment, then relative valuation should work. And he looked at me and said,
and it did?
And it worked fine.
Well, off we went. Excellent. Well, so there's the beginning of the emerging markets, as it were, 25 years ago. Where would you say, and let's make this the go through to the break on this, where do you think frontier markets are now compared to where emerging markets were then? Do you think that they're in approximately the same place, and is there the same degree of illiquidity, inefficiency, distaste on the part of investors, all those good things you look for, the embarrassment factor, as you mentioned, because obviously that's one of our major theses here, that in fact investors should be looking at frontier markets in the same way as they looked at emerging markets 20-odd years ago.
Well, if you think of the fact that the phrase or the anagram BRIC is so easily recognized by everybody,
yep.
it took 20 years for that to happen. I would say that BRIC should include a K for Korea, but then yep. Koreas might not like that association to the other entries there. If you now take a look at where especially the African markets would be,
yep.
One of our major theses was that if you either had an intellectual base, like Ireland, let's say, I'm not saying Ireland is a frontier market in any way, but I'm saying that's a pretty strong place because of that. Many of the world markets that are coming into focus now have very strong natural resources. And in a natural resources-driven, commodity-driven world, with China and others as consumers, the money capital is knocking at the door to want to do something. And what happens then is the capital spreads outside of a copper mine country, let's say, to other enterprises that are promising. And if you take the new influence of EduX, I think it's called, where the many universities are going to put things online. So you can be in Nigeria, and if you can find an internet connection, you can take a course. And Bill Gates is kind of a big promoter of this, I believe, because tablets are not very expensive.
Yep.
Once you raise the education level and you give people a chance with a little bit of an entrepreneurial break, things happen very rapidly. I think that the ride that comes with the stock prices, with the development of capital markets, is really dependent on whether there's an interplay between government and large financial enterprises to create a stable settlement system. We found that we stayed away from markets in our early days unless we were sure we could settle the trades and find out what the prices were, as crazy as that sounds.
No, I think you're absolutely right there, Rich.
Exactly where they were. Exactly.
But it would be fair, very briefly, to say that you would be comfortable in making that comparison in terms of frontier markets to emerging markets at present levels? Yeah.
If I could just add one thing, I realize you have to go. The ETF explosion is staying so far out ahead of the development of the markets that it will lead to a lot of volatility in the ETFs. I mean, I did a quick survey of things, emerging and frontier, and it's not unusual to have these things move around at an average decline of anywhere from 50 to 70%, but then they rebound anywhere from 40 to 80%. So you're going to have to be, you got to become a timer. I'm an old timer, even though timing is a bad word sometimes. But it's really data driven, and as long as you're conscious of that, these opportunities are just the best out there.
Excellent. Well, Rich, thank you very much indeed. I'd love to come back and explore some more in terms of the development of both the emerging markets and the frontier markets. But really appreciate you being on the show. And that was extremely interesting and illuminating. Thanks very much indeed.
Absolutely, Gavin. It's my pleasure and love to be on anytime.
Thanks so much. Okay. When we come back from the break, I'll be talking to Wazim Khan of Silk Invest, who's in Baku, Azerbaijan. And we'll look at the role of oil revenues in its future and also touching on the situation in Pakistan. Thanks very much.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
This program is produced by EFMI Media, which has become the leader in information about emerging and frontier markets investing. EFMI recently compiled the book entitled Investing in Frontier Markets, Opportunity, Risk, and Role in an Investment Portfolio, set for release by John Wiley & Sons later this year, and another book, also on frontier markets, which will be on store bookshelves later in the year. We are also launching a newsletter called EFMI. For more information, email info@emergingfrontier.ca. For more news about upcoming program segments, the books we have written, or the EFMI newsletter, please email info@emergingfrontier.ca. You can call 416-944-1750.
You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back. I'm Gavin Graham. We have Wazim Khan on the line from Baku, Azerbaijan. Wazim is Chief Investment Officer of a private equity fund at Silk Invest, which specializes in frontier funds. He's on a research trip in Azerbaijan and taking time out to talk to us. Welcome back to the program, Wazim.
Thank you very much, Gavin. Pleasure to be here.
I've talked to several of other of our guests about former Soviet bloc countries, which are in various stages of making the move from the old-style communist regime towards being a full market economy. How far along that route would you suggest Azerbaijan has come?
I guess Azerbaijan has definitely is ahead of the game to some extent compared to some of the other countries, because Azerbaijan, like Kazakhstan, is endowed with huge natural resources in terms of hydrocarbons. So that has really helped the economic growth in the country and stabilized the local issues, the political issues, and so on and so forth. But obviously, it is not without its challenges and distractions that are there, and there are several of them. So essentially, yes, I mean, it's done well. Economic growth has been quite high in the past. It has started to slow down in 2011 and 2012, but it's starting to pick back up again this year.
And obviously, one of the major drivers of that growth has been their oil resources. Azerbaijan and Baku were one of the original oil booms back at the end of the 19th century. And here again, at the end of the 20th, beginning of the 21st, they're a major player. Would it be fair to say that oil is the principal but not the only reason to be in the country?
I would agree that it is a major, but not the only one. Actually, if you look at the breakdown of the economy in total, the energy sector accounts for 30% of the economy. Infrastructure accounts for 40% of the economy. And financial sector about 21% of the economy. And then agribusiness, commerce, and industry about 10%. So basically, infrastructure obviously is related to the growth in the hydrocarbon sector, because that money comes in from, let's say, oil and gas. And that's prompting to developing infrastructure in the country, which is developing quite a rapid pace. Of course, you still have a long ways to go, that the deterrent to prevent quite a bit in that area. So the economy is at 40%. If you look over the last 2 years, the contribution of the hydrocarbon sector has declined a bit. It's been picked up by the non-oil sector, non-hydrocarbon sector, and primarily infrastructure has been the leading player in that area.
And there is some suggestion that while obviously there's been fairly strong growth and reduction in poverty, improvement in living standards, the old bugbear of corruption seems to be an issue in that it's seen as a drag on growth and maybe as a deterrent to foreign direct investment. Would you agree that with virtually all of the ex-Soviet countries, there's a perceived problem with corruption? How does Azerbaijan rank on that scale, and do you believe it's as big a problem as people may have suggested?
Sure. Azerbaijan obviously is along the same line as corruption, as far as corruption is concerned, with some of the other Soviet countries. But it's not as bad as it would be, for example, in Russia itself or in the Ukraine or some of the other countries. Things are moving, actually progressing ahead. So if I was to look at a few sort of statistics here, Azerbaijan has moved up along the ranking levels in terms of some of the areas, such as, for example, ease of doing business. Azerbaijan used to be about 69th on it about 2 years ago. It has moved up to the 66th level. At the same time, if you look at some of the other areas in terms of indicators that suggest whether Azerbaijan has moved up, for example, in the global competitiveness ranking that is released by the World Economic Forum, which actually the last one released in September 2012, Azerbaijan moved up 9 places to the 46th rank. So the government is actually trying to streamline a lot of things. Recently, they basically tried to streamline the tax system. Also, at the same time, they introduced some new insurance areas where and customs policies and so on and so forth, which have been all digitalized and streamlined in a sense where it's becoming more easier for people to do business than it was before.
So that's obviously encouraging developments. And the other major factor, I presume, would be that the government is very keen to encourage foreign direct investment, obviously a reason for your presence there, and that such things as improvement in ease of doing business is obviously a good gauge to attract the potential investment from foreign investors.
Sure. I mean, the government is really actually very open in that sense. The government really wants foreign investment in the country, along with especially technical know-how. There's no question about that. But I think what the government has to do is the government has to take some further more steps where things are made much more clear for foreign investors, so that foreign investors can be assured that not only the capital is going to be shared, but through the creation of the capital and given what they have, that they would be able to repatriate those. That's number one. So there are some areas around that things are not very clear as yet. Then again, you know, I mean, very simple things such as visas and passport controls and things like that, that needs to be also streamlined and it's easier now. Because if you put in an institution of people coming into the country for business reasons, then that's a kind of a barrier to foreign direct investment. So there are certain areas where we still need to do a lot more work.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for bringing us your thoughts on the outlook for Azerbaijan. Briefly, Pakistan, which we touched on, I think, the last time you were on, two, 3 weeks back. Just your thoughts on the potential wind down of U.S. military efforts. Would that have a negative effect on the economy in Pakistan? Again, because there is a perception that the amount of U.S. military aid has certainly been helpful to the progress of the economy, and if that's going to be reduced, that's not going to be a good thing in general.
Yeah, I think there are two things there. One, obviously, is that Pakistan politically is very, very important to the United States foreign policy in the region. So the fact that even though that U.S. military aid may be reduced a bit, it will still continue to be a major provider for exchange to the government of Pakistan. U.S. will have to, it will continue to provide some type of military aid to Pakistan. especially to fight against insurgents that that have grown quite substantially over the past two decades. The second thing is that, and this again goes in the blessing of the United States government, that IMF is willing to sign on a $5 billion credit program for Pakistan. And then once the government takes over, I think that things will be speeded up in that area, and that the use of money from the IMF will pay the way for a lot of other foreign investment coming into Pakistan. So I think that things are looking up for Pakistan, not at the rate that I would like to see, as the Pakistan other investors in frontier markets would like to see, but it will be there, and you will see that progress made in terms of foreign direct investment. The local stock market is already reflecting that inflow of capital that will be coming in soon.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Wazim, both for the thoughts on Pakistan, but also Azerbaijan, and obviously those former Soviet republics are an interesting market area for frontier market investors, and somewhere like Azerbaijan, which does have lots of natural resources, is obviously does at least have the resources to, or the funds to actually improve in the way that you were describing. Okay. So thanks very much.
If you have a minute, if I could.
Yeah.
The only thing I wanted to add as far as Azerbaijan is concerned, that in terms of capital market investment, there's not much here at this stage. I mean, the stock market is very small and not very liquid. Basically, it's a two-way market as far as I'm concerned. But from a direct investment point of view, Azerbaijan, which is a country with about 9 to 9.5 million people, basically all kinds of consumer-related and several consumer both items and services, manufacturing services and food industries. I think there's a huge opportunity. The government is open and willing to basically provide all kinds of facilities to foreigners that can come here. There is a bit of bureaucracy, yes. If it's reduced by the government, it's been done gradually. But I think that that foreign direct investment, if looking for a home in the former Soviet bloc, would find Azerbaijan a very attractive place.
Excellent. Thanks, Wazim, and hope to have you back soon. Thanks. We've been talking to Wazim Khan on the line from Baku, Azerbaijan, and he was making that point about the capital markets are not particularly well developed. There's not a great deal in terms of investable stocks for public market investors. On the other hand, the foreign direct investment field, which is one of his briefs, does look very interesting and very attractive indeed. When I come back from the break, we'll head to Medellin, Colombia, to talk about equities there with Rupert Stebbings at Valores Bancolombia. He sees several types of companies that look attractive, including cement manufacturers.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
This program comes to you from the EFMI Media Company. EFMI Media is one of the most comprehensive sources of information and analysis on emerging and frontier markets. EFMI Media has become a leader in knowledge, expertise, and analysis of emerging and frontier markets, both in opportunities to investigate and pitfalls to avoid. For further information about EFMI Media, go to www.emergingfrontier.ca or call 416-944-1750. EFMI Media produces this program, researched and wrote Investing in Frontier Markets, Opportunity, Risk, and Role in an Investment Portfolio, which is set for release later this year, and is currently working on a second book, also on frontier markets. EFMI also publishes a newsletter called EFMI Information and provides knowledgeable speakers on these and other topics. For further information about EFMI Media, go to www.emergingfrontier.ca, write to info@emergingfrontier.ca, or call 416-944-1750. You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing. I'm Gavin Graham. Some analysts see Colombia as one of the more promising frontier markets, and we previously talked to Paul Harris, who's editor and publisher of the Colombia Gold Letter, about the mining sector there, and got a little bit of an update on the political situation. Today we're going to have a closer look at some equities there with Rupert Stebbings, who's vice president of equities and research at Valores Bancolombia. I have him on the line in Medellin. He worked in equities for 19 years, starting at Robert Fleming in London, where he specialized in Asian and then Latin American markets, and then in New York as a Latin American specialist for Deutsche Bank, and the last 8 years in Colombia, working at several brokerage houses, including most recently as chief executive officer with Selfin Capital, now with Valores Bancolombia. Thanks for joining us today, Rupert.
My pleasure. Good morning.
Morning. In terms of perceptions, which we were talking about a little earlier in the program, would it be fair to say that Colombia has successfully overcome the widespread perception of violence and civil insurrection, which characterized it for a number of years?
Yeah, I think a lot of the old kind of myths about Colombia have now been lifted. And I think in terms of a barrier to entry for overseas investors, I think they've now seen beyond that. I mean, obviously on a day-to-day basis, you know, Colombia always makes the headlines. Overseas news agencies always seem much happier to report negative news from Colombia, but which is the way of the world. But I think in terms of individual investors and funds coming to visit, they've seen past that problem, and they can see just coming to visit that things are not as they were and not as they're perceived in much of the world.
And in fact, foreign investors do seem to be displaying increasing interest in Colombian equities, without obviously revealing any trade secrets in terms of the actual identities. Would it be fair to say that a number of American firms have been displaying increasing interest in Colombian equities and actually putting some money in?
I think it's unquestionable. I mean, when I first came here in 2006, you know, we'd have a very occasional visitor, a very occasional curious fund would come and visit, normally bottom-up funds, and they would take a look at the country and decide it was very expensive in terms of the stocks because they couldn't see the bigger picture, the top-down story. And as time's rolled on, now we have investors here the whole time. And whereas before, you know, companies would be 1% owned by foreigners, maybe. Now we've got companies which have over 10% foreign participation, which next to Brazil or other countries is still very low. But their interest, whether the funds come from New York, from Boston, the wealth of funds on the West Coast, Miami, you know, they come from all over the U.S., and they certainly haven't been investing. At the same time, we've seen the Colombian companies themselves, you know, pick themselves up and find confidence, and they travel extensively as well. I mean, only I think it was yesterday we had the Colombia Day in New York, which is all the companies went there, attended by funds, and again they'll repeat that roadshow, which will go over to London. So, the combination of funds coming here and the corporates here having the confidence to travel and tell their story has certainly changed the outlook, and yes, we've seen increasing numbers of investors here.
Well, you mentioned that some of the more cautious investors a few years ago couldn't see the improving macro story. What does the economy look like this year? Obviously, growth is improving, but the government seems to feel it might be helpful to stimulate a little bit as well.
Yeah, it's a strange situation. I mean, we have the government looking for a 4.8% growth rate this year, the central bank are at 4.3%. Ourselves, we're looking at 4.2%. And it seems bizarre in this backdrop and versus Brazil, which can hardly put a point in growth together, that somehow we're struggling and we need a stimulus plan. And, you know, that was put into place a few weeks ago. It's not enormous, but at the same time, you know, behind the stimulus plan, we have an election coming in a year's time. And 4.2% or 4.8% is probably not enough for the government. They're trying to show more. And, yeah, it seems bizarre. You know, a country that's probably going to be a top 10 GDP growth country in the world supposedly needs a stimulus plan, which is bizarre. I mean, yes, versus previous years, we're in a relative slump. You know, Colombia, for those who don't know, has only ever been in one recession in its history, which is very unusual. But yeah, we're in a comparative slump apparently. And I think a lot of it's caused by confidence. The Colombian investor is a
is a shy character. The economy, really, you could say, in modern terms, is only about 10 years old since Alvaro Uribe came to power and instilled a lot of confidence in investors. So, you know, the first cause of or sign of problems, and a lot of the problems are obviously overseas, you know, as an exporter of oil, a lot of commodities, those prices have been hit. You know, the first sign of trouble, you know, they take their money and they stuff it in the mattress and they save it for a rainy day. And what the government has tried to do is obviously to encourage them to spend. High GDP growth always looks good on the CV or the resume come election time. So, you know, I think that's the situation basically at the moment. The economy is fine, yep. But for politicians, it's not fine enough.
So, assuming that growth continues around low to mid 4% GDP, are there any particular sectors and within that any particular individual stocks that you would pick out in terms of ones that might be doing well and might be of interest to investors or potential investors in Colombia?
Well, the stimulus plan was, you know, in terms of investors, the stimulus plan is basically, you know, they're going to spend around 1% of GDP, the gain 1.8%. This is the theory anyway. And a lot of that is bringing forward tax benefits for those who employ extra people. And also there's a broad-ranging credit subsidy program. So the consumer sector should benefit in general. And then they're also, you know, they're pressuring, and against this, they're also pressurizing banks to cut rates. I mean, there are hundreds of millions of dollars in infrastructure projects which are being brought forward. Now, an infrastructure is an interesting sector because the government has a $25 billion infrastructure program on the table. They have started tendering the process now. I think probably the first 25% of that is already under tender. And, you know, these tenders will attract 30 or 40 foreign companies at a time. So, you know, obviously the construction sector is extremely important here and will be going forward. This is a country that I think ranks 115th in the world in terms of infrastructure. I'll give you a simple idea. If you're sat in the middle of the country where a lot of the industry is, it costs twice as much to pass and take a container to the coast in Colombia as it does in any other country with a free trade agreement with the U.S. So the roads are absolutely essential here.
Presumably cement might be a sector that would be a beneficiary?
Yeah, totally. I mean, if you want to look at the bigger companies, you're looking at a company like Cementos Argos, which has around 51% of all cement supply in this country. And roads here are largely built in cement. They're not built in asphalt. And the road projects themselves, interestingly enough, they come with literally hundreds of tunnels and hundreds of bridges because of the topography of the country. You know, it looks like the Alps, you know, top to bottom.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of concrete involved, and if you're the number one cement supplier in the country, you're going to be a huge beneficiary.
And you said also the consumer should benefit. Presumably the banks who are going to be helping lend the consumer and providing them with credit cards and auto loans and stuff like that will also be beneficiaries.
The banks are a little bit of a case of, you know, the jury is out right now because – at the same time as announcing the stimulus plan, there's been tremendous criticism of our banks because, you know, we've seen, you know, central bank rates here collapse. Like, they've come down hugely to 3.25%. And really, the banks have done nothing. The mortgage rates stayed where they were, credit rates.
Mm-hmm.
Colombia as a country had a huge crisis in 2000. Everything went to pieces. Banks stopped lending. And they learned the lesson. And they are now very reluctant lenders, you know, and they are very conservative by international standards. I mean, for example, non-performing loans here are measured on a 30-day basis, not on a 90-day, which is the more accepted international standard. So they're very conservative. So on the one side, yes, you have the government saying, you've got to lower rates, you've got to lend more money, and the government's helping that with a mortgage stimulus plan, which is basically we'll pay, you know, a third of the mortgage payment. The bank covers the rest if it's for the right rate. Now, that brings a lot of mortgage business through the door, and that's great. On the other side, they're saying to them, you've got to bring credit down in general. Now, that's obviously going to hit net interest margins. So we have to wait and see where the balance lies, where the extra business is going to outweigh the lower margin. So to an extent, the jury is out on the banks right now, although banks here are tremendously well capitalized. I mean, this is one thing that, yes, it came from the 2000 problem. And since 2008, the banks here have had absolutely no problem at all. I mean, they're hugely capitalized, non-performing loans are low even on that 30-day basis. But at the same time, it's made them reluctant lenders, and the government's become aware of this. And, you know, the government's trying to get them to help, you know, refloat this economy, which, as we say, is not in the worst condition anyway, but that's the government's perspective, that they need them to help.
So Summing it up, you'd have to say that the economy looks relatively healthy. There are some obvious beneficiaries from the stimulus program, although as with the banks, it depends on striking the balance between reductions in net interest margin and expansion in business. Will they make it up in volume? Is there anything that you would give you cause for concern if you were someone looking at Colombia? Is there a, I understand that the negotiations between FARC and the government seem to be going relatively well, and that there may well be a settlement coming in at some stage.
Yeah, I mean, it's an election year, so you know we have an election in a year's time, and much like the US, everything kind of shuts down for election time. So we have a lot of infighting about the election. Obviously, Juan Manuel Santos was defense minister under Uribe. Uribe, when he basically held him into power, expected him to continue the same policies. Santos has taken a shift towards the center, not towards the left, but towards the center. And as part of this, he's gone, because Santos had a lot of problems to try and organize the infrastructure program, which arguably would have been his legacy, his shift has moved to the peace process. And he is a little bit all in on this peace process, because if he gets the peace process and has the paper in the hand, he can certainly push forward for a re-election. If it fails, he may have to step aside and let somebody else in his group, you know, stand for election. It's quite feasible. The process is going well. It's a very long process. What the guerrillas are actually asking for isn't too much. But at the same time, internally, there's an enormous, you know, collision between the extreme, not the extreme right, but the right of Álvaro Uribe and the followers of Santos. You know, those of Uribe are saying the guerrillas should pay, they should do time in prison, you know, and all that side. Where Santos is pushing towards the, you know, live and let live, let bygones be bygones. And there's a tremendous collision here. And then across the border, we have Venezuela with their new,
yes,
Nicolas Maduro, the new president, also making a lot of noise. For example, over the weekend, we had news that, or reports that Colombia was going to join NATO. Well, that created more problems. They've now denied it. So it's an election year. I don't think in terms of, let's make it simple, even with all the noise, without a peace process, the World Bank has Colombia rated globally as the number five country in the world for protection of investors. The legal system here is extremely rigid. Investors are very well protected. With all the mining and the oil and all the money that's come in over the years, there's really been a fraction of problems with investors who've had problems. And normally their problems caused by their own, you know, their own mistakes.
Unfamiliarity with local customs, would it be fair to say?
Sorry, could you repeat that?
I was going to say that caused by their own some of their own actions or their unfamiliarity.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough. I think, you know, they overstep the mark. The mining sector has been particularly, the mining sector here is gets a good and a bad press. I mean, there's, as ever, it's a few who spoil it for everyone else. So, you know, a few people, you know, overstep the mark on the land they have for mining, and obviously that reflects badly on other miners who are doing a tremendous job here in helping the community. But apart from those very few examples, you know, investors here really seem to have had no problems, and I think that's well reflected what the World Bank had to say. It's a very legalistic country, and even speaking to the mining people, despite all the noise, you speak to the average miner, and he's like pretty happy with his lot here, and he feels okay, the stuff could be improved, but it's an emerging market, so there's always there are things that can be improved.
Excellent. Well, thanks very much indeed, Rupert. That's been extremely useful and lots of very valuable information. Hope we can reconnect and see how things are developing in not too distant future.
Whenever you need, Kevin. Have a good day.
Thanks. That was Rupert Stebbings at Valores Bank Colombia, giving us some more information on Colombia. And again, it's unsurprising that Colombia ranks fairly high, if not at the top of a lot of analysts and observers' list of the most attractive frontier-emerging markets. When I come back from the break, I'll check in with our African correspondent Samuel Okoja on the line from Lagos, Nigeria, for a look at the African activities of some of the major telecom companies that you may hold in your global funds. Please stay right here.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
Do you like what you hear about investing in emerging and frontier markets on this program? Would you like to learn more to increase your investing effectiveness? EFMI Media also publishes a subscription-based newsletter called EFMI. We'd like to tell you more about it. Drop us an email at info@emergingfrontier.ca. We've designed EFMI as a newsletter to provide expert and up-to-date news and analysis of opportunities in the same markets that we discuss here on Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. EFMI as information and analysis that you won't find anywhere else. And you can start receiving it by emailing info@emergingfrontier.ca.
You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Hi, welcome back. I am Gavin Graham, and this is Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing. We're heading into today's final segment where we'll be talking to our African correspondent from Lagos, Nigeria, Samuel Okoja. One of the themes that we explore periodically is that an investor may already have more exposure to emerging or frontier markets than he or she realizes. For example, the major telecommunication companies have been big beneficiaries of the growth in demand for particularly mobile phone services, but also equipment in general in the African markets. Your global mutual fund may own shares in these companies, almost certainly does, and they may actually have a significant exposure to emerging and frontier markets, including African markets. So welcome, Samuel. Hi, Samuel.
Hello, good morning and good afternoon.
Good afternoon, indeed, for where you are. So we're going to be talking about the global telecoms companies. Could you let us know what makes Africa such an attractive market for these companies?
Yes, well, many regions of the world are reaching mobile saturation right now, but Africa still has lots of room for growth. As a matter of fact, it has the largest room for growth because the mobile revolution is taking its roots. According to records, over the next 2 years, mobile handset penetration in Africa is expected to grow to 85%. As more people also switch from feature phones to smartphones, new areas of tech sector growth will open for smartphone manufacturers like Apple, Samsung, Nokia. You know, so the market right now is a growing one in Africa. And it makes it very, very key for investors to look towards this site.
Well, you mentioned Apple and a couple of other companies. Why don't we, and with the growing acceptance of smartphones in Africa, why don't we start with Apple, as so many other financial discussions seem to? How are they doing in African markets, and what sort of product penetration do they have?
Yes, for Apple can capitalize on the shifts once consumers in developing markets are used to smartphones. Right now, the level of penetration of iPhone in Africa is pretty low. As a matter of fact, it's the lowest when compared to Samsung and BlackBerry. And that's because the price range of the iPhone is on the high side, and they've not been able to produce from the mass market. So right now, Apple is not doing pretty well in Africa in terms of penetration. However, by the time Africans begin to move to smartphones, because right now feature phones remain dominant in Africa, Apple can take advantage of that, making phones that would be widely available for the mass market. So while the shift for feature phones to smartphones takes place, Apple can strategically place itself to fill in that. So right now, Apple is not doing very well compared to companies like BlackBerry.
And so how is BlackBerry doing? Because they've made a point that Africa is one of their stronger areas.
Yes, BlackBerry is doing pretty well in Africa. In South Africa, for instance, BlackBerry has about 51% share of the smartphone market in Nigeria, the situation is not very different. BlackBerry is very popular in Africa because of the BBM service, which allows people to chat for basically free across BlackBerry devices. However, there is a major challenge right now because other smartphones are beginning to offer similar services. For example, the Nokia Asha range of phones offers the messaging service WhatsApp free of charge on its phone. So what that means is that lots of people can experience the same service in the BlackBerry phones on other smartphone devices with that application. So the competition is pretty steep right now, but as it is, BlackBerry still occupies a major share of smartphone markets in Africa, especially in South Africa and Nigeria.
So the major competitor to Apple, of course, in the smartphone market has been an emerging markets company, Samsung, from South Korea. Are they also benefiting from that move towards smartphones, but do they also have a meaningful presence in the feature phones?
Yeah, for Samsung is doing pretty well. The good thing about Samsung is that they are spreading their nets. They have the high-end smartphone, and they have the smartphone with the low-range price. For example, in Nigeria, we have some smartphones by Samsung that goes for around $100, you know, so that's what's really keeping companies like Samsung pretty strong in Africa, and they are really, really trying to get penetration in the continent. I can tell you right now that Samsung is a major force to reckon with when it comes to mobile phones in Africa, especially in the area of smartphones. And when I say mobile devices, that includes devices like the tablet and, of course, the mobile phone itself. I can tell you one thing very, very clearly with confidence. Samsung is very popular in Nigeria, and the same story can be heard in other parts of Africa. The driving force for Samsung, like I said, is the price range of their phones, in addition with the high-end price. It's a pretty mix of high and low. So they have cheap Android devices and they have the high-end ones.
So that's a pretty strong position for Samsung. Their former rival, Nokia, has been having a pretty tough few years. You mentioned that it is actually coming out with a sort of BBM equivalent and has been gaining some market share because of that. In Africa, does it still have a fairly major presence in the African market?
Yes, Nokia has a pretty strong presence in Africa. Before now, Nokia used to be the most popular telecoms company in Africa with this range of feature phones. However, the coming of BlackBerry devices in the smartphone market now made Nokia to look seeming unpopular. However, they are coming up with a range of what I call smarter phones, especially in the Asha range devices. So that means that Asha phone has a messaging app like that of BlackBerry in WhatsApp. With WhatsApp, you can chat with any person using a smartphone or WhatsApp app. So that has enabled Nokia to gradually, you know, regain the make a very strong presence in the smartphone market. When it comes to the feature phones, it's Nokia's space. Nokia has that space. But right now they are trying to, you know, take that, the space from BlackBerry and other companies in terms of smartphones. So with a short range of devices, they are beginning to get a pretty good share of the market when it comes to smartphone devices. What that means is that the competition is getting stiffer for even BlackBerry and Samsung with the coming of Nokia with its own range of smarter phone devices.
So to summarize, Samuel, it's all the major players are in Africa and they all have their sort of strengths in different parts of the market, with probably Apple because of the price issue being the one with the smallest exposure. But obviously, as you said, the opportunity to get higher levels of penetration, because what would be the average penetration in, say, Nigeria, Kenya, South Africa at the moment in terms of mobile phone penetration? Would we be looking at 65-75%? Because obviously that does present an opportunity, as you mentioned.
Yes, for Africa, you know, the penetration is still low because there is still large room for growth, which means there are lots of opportunities for these companies. In the next 2 years, like I did earlier, it's predicted that penetration will reach 85%. So what that means is that the space is still pretty large for most of the telecom companies. It's very difficult right now to say which company is occupying the top spot in terms of penetration.
But there's lots of opportunity, really, for all of them, it would be fair to say, Samuel. We have to wind it up now, but thank you very much indeed. That's been a very useful insight into the strong position of a number of global telecom stocks in Africa. Be speaking to you again sooner. Thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you very much. Take care.
So that wraps up today's program. Please join us again next week, where I'll be talking to Wall Street veteran James Awad from Plimsoll Mark Capital, a division of Zephyr Management in New York. And also, we're hoping to talk to Fernando Donaire at Inca Investments in Miami, Florida, about the advantages of investing in Mexico. Our European correspondent, Maria Marcinek, will be back to talk about the possibility that recession might be starting to come to an end. And I'll be talking to economics professor and consultant Atif Kubersi about the state of Egypt and what it would take for the country to eventually become attractive for investment. I'm Gavin Graham. Our producer is Al Ahmed. We are the co-authors of Investing in Frontier Markets, Opportunity, Risk, and Role in an Investment Portfolio, scheduled for release by John Wiley & Sons in the late summer of this year, and another book on frontier markets set for release before the end of the year. We're also the publishers of the EFMI newsletter. For more information, please write to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Again, that's info@emergingfrontier.ca. Thanks, and please join us next week.
Thanks for listening today to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with host Gavin Graham. Be sure to join us again next Wednesday at 6 a.m. Pacific Time, 9 a.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel for another edition. Have a profitable week.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the hosts or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.